And it is today's Topical Currents, Joseph Cooper, alongside Bonnie Berman. Think about who would qualify as your intimate contacts, and also those who'd fall into casual acquaintances in that sphere. But what's become of the once central relationship with one's neighbors? Mark Dunkelman is a Brown University research fellow and a senior fellow at the Clinton Foundation. He holds a theory in his new book, The Vanishing Neighbor, The Transformation of American Community. And he joins us from Brown University in Providence, Rhode Island. Welcome to you, Mark Dunkelman.
Thanks for having me.
Good to have you. So let's start right with these middle rings. You see it as the root of this massive transformation in the architecture of our society, the loss of middle ring relationships. What do you mean by those relationships? Who are they?
And it's Saturn we're referring to.
Yes. Well, he'll tell us.
So if you think about your entire social universe and try to place everyone you know on a diagram that looks like the rings of Saturn, with the people that you're most intimate with, your spouse, your kids, your parents, your best friends, in the innermost rings, and then people with successively less intimacy moving out towards the outer rings, to maybe the outermost ring would be somebody that you who served you a cup of coffee a couple days ago at a diner and you wouldn't even know their name. If you put everybody you know on that continuum, my argument is that over the last several decades, we've taken more and more of our time and attention and moved it away from the relationships in the middle rings. So those are the people that you're familiar with but not intimate. People that you might meet at the PTA or at the Rotary Club or the neighbor down the street. People you would know enough to have a substantive conversation with, but whom you might not know everything about their lives. Our time and attention has been moved away from those relationships and instead, we're spending more time and attention on the most intimate relationships and the ones way far out with people who have maybe a single common affinity. Maybe they root for the Dolphins. Maybe they love to crochet. Maybe they share your political predilections. In each case, though, you know very little about them, and the relationship is really formed across that single shared interest.
As far as intimate contacts, I was thinking as I read your book that the intimate contacts in this day when everyone is on your cell phone contact list, the few people that you can actually recall in memory what their phone number is.
That's probably right.
Those are your most intimate contacts.
Right. Well, what are the detriments of not having these middle ring relationships? Why are they so important?
The middle rings are unique because they are the place where we learn to understand what people with different worldviews think. In the innermost rings, people love you implicitly. Rarely are you going to have a disagreement about a way to view the world. Maybe you and your spouse have a different point of view. But in general, those are people that love you implicitly, and you're not going to have big disagreements. The outermost rings, if someone disagrees with you, well, you just abandon them for a different outer ring relationship. If you're a big Miami Dolphins fan and it turns out that the person that you're blogging with is actually a Buffalo Bills fan, you'll just abandon that relationship, no sweat, and move on to the next
one. Well, the Dolphin fans are dwindling as we speak. go ahead.
But those in the middle, those relationships with the person down the street or who you know at the PTA or who joins you in your bowling league, if they disagree with you or they have a different point of view, you can't avoid them. You can't, it's not convenient to turn away entirely from the relationship. It's where you begin to think about, you know, maybe I don't agree with them about X, Y, or Z. Maybe I have a different point of view on a political issue, or maybe I have a different idea about what we ought to do downtown with some open space. But what they're saying, I may not agree with it, but it's not crazy. And that step, moving from thinking that someone's way off base to the idea that maybe they just have a different point of view and it's a legitimate point of view, that's the first step toward building real compromise in the political sphere or finding real collaboration in the economic sphere or even in how we build a real successive a successful dynamic social safety net. That's the first step. And so absent those middle ring relationships, it's much harder for Americans to build functioning institutions. So, and I'm sure we'll talk about this soon, that's, in my view, why Washington seems so dysfunctional, why economic innovation seems to be slowing, why our social safety net seems to be coming apart. It's all because in the course of our day-to-day lives, we're investing less time and attention in those middle ring relationships.
You say that it affects our ability to feel and maintain empathy. I don't understand that connection.
So, in those middle ring relationships, you're talking to somebody who has a different point of view. You need to learn, in that case, not to lash out when they say, well, I supported Sarah Palin, or, well, I really, I think that we ought to be doing something different on agricultural policy, or I like this kind of television show. You can't turn away from those relationships. You need to have the wherewithal to stick with it. And in the absence of having to do that, if you can avoid those middle ring relationships, which we've been empowered to do over the last several decades, we never really have to harness the empathetic impulse to begin to understand where people who have different points of view are coming from.
So compare this to, say, the 1950s, before the third wave.
In the 1950s, well, let me take a step back. A whole series of changes have come to define the last several decades, and we tend to talk about them individually. We talk about the digital revolution, or the fact that the service economy has overcome the manufacturing economy, or the fact that women are now in the professional workforce, or that we can travel more easily, or that we've suburbanized. All these changes we talk about too frequently in isolation. If you put them together, the composite effect is that the rhythms of life that defined the 1950s in many cases, where we centered our lives around our neighborhoods, where we were heavily invested in the sorts of institutions that we think of when we think about the idyllic 1950s. They weren't so idyllic, but when we think about the 50s, we think about the PTA and the Rotary Club and the kids on the street. Those institutions were the institutions that brought communities together across their differences. And we've abandoned those relationships so that we can spend more time with the people we love most, which is a perfectly wonderful thing. And we've abandoned them because we can now find people who agree with us implicitly. But absent those middle rings, it's much harder to build the sort of collaborative network of contacts that existed in the 1950s and really right through all of American history.
Today, does this start in childhood? I noticed that compared to my youth, kids aren't out just having fun by themselves, making up their own games, playing hide-and-seek, pick-up basketball games. It's all organized, and there's even such things as play dates. I doubt if my mother would have known what a play date was.
You know, I think that's true. There's a great movie that came out in the 80s, I think it was called Stand By Me, about four kids in a little town in Maine who get together and have an adventure out in the woods. And they all had different interests. One was a athlete, one was a real comic book fanatic, one was a writer. The question today is whether in our environment today, those kids with different interests and different backgrounds would find one another in their neighborhood. Or would the writer be online talking to other kids who wanted to write? Or would the kid who was a comic book fanatic find a club online or somewhere in the neighborhood of people who were really interested in comic books? Would they build those relationships among colleagues and peers who had different interests? Or would they become much more ensconced with peers who really shared their point of view?
You know, I started thinking about this in the book because most of us want to avoid conflict. And why wouldn't we, you know? So why would we want to engage with people with differing points of view? Because it seems that what's disappearing is moderation, that people are more extreme. Maybe it's the art of disagreeing and conversation that it's at risk instead of these middle ring relationships?
Well, you're absolutely right that people are avoiding, and often for good reason, they're avoiding the interactions they know will be uncomfortable. If you know that someone else has a different point of view or is voting for the other candidate or roots for the other football team or works for a competing industry, in all those cases, who wants to have that interaction, particularly when you can look down at your phone or call your best friend or get online and find someone who agrees with you? I wonder in the 1950s if our grandparents and our parents had had the same opportunities to find people who agreed with them, they might have taken those opportunities. But the fact is that the fact that previous generations couldn't avoid one another, the fact that in the course of their everyday life, they couldn't avoid talking to people, interacting with people who had different points of view, that was really the foundation for American exceptionalism. That was what distinguished colonial American community from the structure of community that existed in Europe. And so, really, for the first time in American history, for the first time in more than 200 years, we fundamentally altered the foundational elements of American community so that there are fewer of these interactions across disparate points of view. And that, I'm arguing, is really the crucial transformation that we've failed to recognize and failed to appreciate the implications.
So let's say the Rush Limbaugh listeners, supporters, don't have much contact with those who think he's awful. In the 50s, would, say, an educated person who thought that Joe McCarthy was doing the right thing and exposing communism in government, how would he have been viewed by his colleagues who were also, say, college educated? Would he be, well, he must be a nut job or something, or, mm-hmm. or would have been less of that kind of feeling?
Well, there would certainly have been people who thought that person was nuts, and there probably that guy who was a McCarthy supporter would have thought that those who were ignoring the communist threat, in his view, were also nuts. The question is whether those two types of people would have, over the course of their lives, actually had a conversation about it over a cup of coffee, or while they were waiting for their shoes at the bowling league, or whether they were in the vestibule waiting for the PTA meeting to get going. The question is whether they sit by themselves, sort of only vaguely aware that one exists as happens today, and assume that the other is way off base, or whether through the course of those conversations that they would have had in the 50s, more likely, they would have begun to say, you know, I don't agree with this guy's position on McCarthy or on communism, but I understand he's got a point of view that I can sort of understand where he's coming from. Without that sort of foundational element of understanding, you know, I don't agree, the other side isn't entirely crazy. I can see why they think they do. It's impossible to get to the next step, which is, here's a problem that we both recognize as a problem. We have different views on how to solve it, but let's begin to collaborate and see where we can't agree.
We're speaking with Mark Dunkelman. He's a research fellow at Brown University's Alfred Taubman Center for Public Policy and American Institutions, and a senior fellow at the Clinton Foundation. He's written The Vanishing Neighbor, The Transformation of American Community. We're going to take a short break. We're going to come back and open the phones as well.
It's 22 minutes past 1 o'clock. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and Mark Dunkelman with you. He's a Brown University Research Fellow, a senior fellow at the Clinton Foundation, and we're discussing his new book, The Vanishing Neighbor, The Transformation of American Community. Tell me, Mark Dunkelman, the difference in social capital that you talk about in the book from years of ore and today.
Well, we tend, when we talk about social capital in the world of academics, to think of social capital as something that goes up and down like the temperature. So there are certain times when we had more social capital and certain times when we had less. The argument broadly has been that social capital has diminished over the course of the post-war period. So we were at a high, there was a lot of social capital, which by this definition is just connections between Americans. There was a lot of social capital in the 50s, and really went up during the 60s, and then you hit the 70s and it begins to diminish, and a lot of people have become worried about it. I think we ought to think of social capital through a different prism. Think of it as actual capital, something that we each possess, a certain amount of time and attention. And you can invest that social capital however you like. So it may be that some of us want to spend all of our time and attention with a few people who are very close to us, and we sort of cloister ourselves off. We've invested the bulk of our social capital in our inner ring relationships. It may be that some people really are almost hermits, but they are talking to people who agree with them on certain issues by themselves. They don't know the people personally, but they're online all the time. Those are people who would invest more heavily in the outer rings. My argument broadly is that for the first time in American history, we are taking social capital that was once invested in the middle rings, in these PTA relationships, or bowling league pals, or folks we had over to play bridge. We're taking social capital away from those middle ring relationships and investing them much more heavily in these inner ring relationships with our best friends, being helicopter parents, whatnot, and in the outer rings. So that's the broad shift that I think has set off a whole series of ripples that affect how we govern ourselves, how we drive economic growth, how we care for those who are old and infirm.
You mean I'd rather buy life insurance from Bob because Bob's wife plays bridge with my wife? Or?
Well, I mean that you have the kinds of conversations with people that we were talking about earlier. We have someone who really believes that we need more environmental protection in Biscayne, and others who think that really the businesses should have more latitude to do what they want. If those people disagree on that issue, it is more likely decades ago that they would have had an opportunity to really hash it out in some sort of mediating institution like a coffee shop or a PTA meeting. Today, it's more likely that those two camps would talk much more thoroughly amongst themselves because they could find one another more easily online or through a whole variety of other mechanisms. And so in the absence of that conversation had in the middle rings, it's much harder to find a compromise.
But it also occurs to me, isn't it true that economics are driving more people to work more, giving them less leisure time during which they can have these conversations and these debates? You know, young children are more driven to succeed. Both parents need to work now. Long commutes are sometimes involved. And isn't that a factor that's creating this as well?
Absolutely. There are a whole slew of factors that have come to drive social capital away from the middle rings. And one is certainly that we have less time for leisure activities. And it's a pretty consistent trend over the last few decades. A married couple today is spending generally 12 additional hours per week at work. The question is, in the time that you do have, or even the time that you're at work or at home, are you choosing more frequently to double down on the time that you spend with your kids? Are you tending, when you come home from work, to drive into the garage, close the door, come in, fix dinner, spend time with your kids doing homework, and then get online? And in the limited number of hours that you have in addition, are you choosing to go to a PTA meeting? Are you choosing to spend time on the block? Or are you just happy spending that extra time with your kids and with people that agree with you implicitly in the outer rings?
Hmm. How many people should I have in my middle ring?
Well, that's an interesting question. I'm not trying to be prescriptive in this book. I think people should spend time and how they like and what's comfortable for them.
This is somebody who's not intimate, but also is closer to you than the person you just waved to who lives down the block.
Or your Facebook friend, let's say.
Correct. It's the person who I say you're familiar with, but not intimate. So it's someone you would know well enough to have a conversation with them if their parents are having a tough time, or if their kid's struggling in algebra, or they just bought a new dog. You'd likely know all of those things. And there's research now in the world of anthropology that suggests that our brains are a certain size so that on average an American can really, or I'm sorry, an American, a human can only maintain roughly 150 people in that level of intimacy. So you can learn lots of names and faces and spend time on flashcards and really have a large outer ring population. There are probably only so many people that you can really know intimately. But we tend to assume that you can just sort of grow the number of people who would constitute a middle ring relationship ad infinitum. In fact, our brains are only large enough for us to be able to keep track to an accurate degree about 150 people. And what I'm noting in my book is that the time and attention it takes to keep up that roughly 150 people, we're spending much more thoroughly in the innermost and outermost rings to the detriment of that 150 in the middle.
Do you think this effect is more prevalent in, say, urban areas than rural communities? Because I'm thinking about friends of mine living in a rural community in upstate New York, for an example, and they're always telling me about their communal meals and extended family gatherings on a regular basis. And it seems like, you know, maybe it's not disappearing everywhere.
You're absolutely right. I don't think that this is a uniform shift across America. I think in the aggregate, it's a profound shift, and there's data that supports that. Unfortunately, we don't have necessarily the cross tabs to say it's happening more in this part of the country or among this ethnicity or among folks who are second versus third generation immigrants. We don't know exactly. I will say that the phenomenon I'm talking about, this idea that we are abandoning middle ring relationships for more and less intimate ties, is something that you can find evidence of almost everywhere. So even though we're talking frequently today about how there's a great inversion and people are moving back into center cities across the country, and there's a creative class that wants to be connected to vibrant neighborhoods, in many of those places, just because the area is vibrant, it doesn't mean that people know the people who live next door. It doesn't mean that they are invested in the institutions of that area. Mm. The same is true in rural areas. There are lots of stories of places like in Iowa where Maytag moves out, and the executives who used to live there, who used to invest in the institutions in Iowa, are less inclined to be involved in the PTA and the Rotary Club and whatnot. So you're absolutely right that from town to town and from experience to experience, there are differences. And it would be really fascinating. And if I could find data and I could do more research, this might be exactly where I spent my time, trying to figure out where have middle rings survived, where have they been the most depleted, and what are the differences in those corresponding communities.
Right. Well, let's involve our listeners. Who have you socialized with in, say, the last week, maybe? Last couple of weeks?
Might want to be careful.
Well. Just close friends and family or Facebook friends, you know, the inner circle, the outer circle, like Mark Dunkelman is saying. Or do you have middle ring relationships? We'd love to hear from you. Our number?
1-800-743-9576. 1-800-743-WLRN. And also email. We can have that radio@WLRN.org.
So let's take our break now. And then when we get back, hopefully we'll hear from some of you as well. Mark Dunkelman, research fellow at Brown University and a senior fellow at the Clinton Foundation, The Vanishing Neighbor, The Transformation of American Community is the name of his book.
And we return. It is today's topical currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and we're getting quite a few calls in. That number 1-800-743-9576. We're visiting with Mark Dunkelman, and his book is called The Vanishing Neighbor, The Transformation of American Community. We'll also have links about the book at our website at WLRN.org and also on our Facebook page, Topical Currents.
Facebook.com/Topical Currents. So I think it's really interesting, Mark, because as a society, we've come so far in terms of embracing diversity. So are you saying that although there's been progress and acceptance on several fronts where there wasn't before, that we still tend to stay within our own little spheres and there's not diversity among our middle rings? It's just that we've accepted it more?
Yeah, to some extent that is exactly what I'm saying. The tendency among Americans today is that we are less racist, we're less sexist, we're more accepting of people's sexuality.
Right.
On a whole host of fronts, we are more tolerant than we've ever been. But tolerance isn't driving us to spend more time with people who are different. In many cases, we say, that's fine. You want to be like that? That's fine. That's not my way of thinking. I'm not going to judge you for who you are or what you think. But I am, because I've got the opportunity, going to spend more time with people who agree with me. So you hear in popular culture all the time this phrase, which we don't even think twice about, just be yourself. When people say just be yourself, they mean be the person you are authentically. In many cases, though, it means I am who I am, and I'm going to find people who agree with me. And that's a shift. It's not that we used to invest in the middle rings because we wanted to. It's that we used to invest in the middle rings because we didn't have another choice. Everyone has probably had a moment in their life where they've thought about the social universe that their parents inhabited, who their grandparents knew, who they spent time with, who their best friends were, who was at someone's funeral, and compared it to what they experienced themselves. And they thought, you know, Mom had these three friends, and I've got these two friends, and are they the same sorts of friends, or are they different? I bet you everyone has had that experience. In many cases today, at least in the course of talking about my book with people, I found that everyone has noticed this shift, that their parents had more middle ring ties, not by choice in many cases, but just because that's the way the routines of American society were, and that we spend more time with our friends, our best friends, our family, and more time talking to people who agree with us, and less time with those friendships in the middle.
Hmm. I've always said that's been a detriment sometimes to hosting a public affairs educational radio program, that I'm surrounded by people many times who do think like I do, and
exactly.
Maybe I'm missing the forest for the trees.
Or public radio in general, as we always hear, that it's more progressive.
Sometimes I'll be in a group and they say, well, he works for public radio, and I can tell, oh, he's a real one of those liberals. And I'm looked upon like that.
Well, you know, the day that President Kennedy was assassinated, a third of American households watched the same program, Ed Sullivan. At the height of American Idol's popularity just a few years ago, only 1 in 10, less than 1 in 10 American households were watching that television show. It just is one example of a trend that spans across American life, where we are finding smaller and smaller niches of what exactly interests us. And with the blessing of being able to find people who agree with us implicitly, we lose the almost accidental benefit of having the experience of talking to somebody who has a different point of view.
Do we want to take some calls?
Yeah, let's do that. This is Luli, is that correct, in Miami? Hi.
Hi. Good afternoon. I just wanted to say that I've been listening since the onset of the show, and it's making me a little crazy because I really disagree with what your guest is saying. I feel like most of the relationships, and I'm going to speak only about myself, most of my relationships are middle ring relationships, and they start there. Either I meet you because you are part of the PTA, or you are part of some group of where I work, or having something to do with my parents. And then the shift happens from the middle, either inward or outward, depending on, you know, the situation. Either you move into the middle ring because I have so much contact with you, regardless of what your opinions are on certain topics, political, ecology, whatever, mm-hmm. or you move out of the ring because, again, our contact is lessened because of life, I don't see you as often anymore because I don't work there anymore or because my child has changed schools. So I find that most of my relationships are in the middle, and then they extend, they either move in or they move out. And I also find that social media has allowed us to have those difficult conversations with those people that are in the middle ring because they are our Facebook friends, or they're in the outer ring because they're only Facebook friends or Twitter or Instagram or whatever it is. And you there are people who will look for that conversation, and you can look on any feed and find scathing opinions about, you know, the most ridiculous topic, and also then you have the other extreme all on the same feed. And I find that people are more open to have these conversations because they are easily having them in the digital realm. So I'm happy. I know what my opinion is. I'm happy to talk to you about it. And it's okay to disagree. We'll just agree to disagree. And I find that tolerance is on the upswing. And I see it a lot in my own children who are teenagers. They have friends of all types. And they could care less half the time what your opinion is on something. They're just happy to be together and hanging out.
Those are great points. What do you think, Mark?
Well, I think you're right. Those are great points. And let's hope that there's more of that in America. The data shows that over the course of the last several decades, the number of Americans who say that over the last month they've had dinner with a close family member or a close friend have gone up. The percentage of Americans who say they've had dinner or a substantive conversation with someone who is a friend from outside the neighborhood has gone up. But the percentage of people who have connected with someone who lives near them has gone down. So that doesn't mean that we are completely disconnected from the people who live nearby. It doesn't mean that people aren't engaged at the PTA. But it does suggest that on the whole, there are fewer Americans investing heavily in the middle rings than there were a few generations ago. Now, there are counterexamples everywhere. So we're talking about broad trends. But even if you look at the sorts of organizations that we're investing in, it used to be that we would invest heavily in organizations that lasted from challenge to challenge. So the Rotary Club, you'd be in the Rotary Club for years, and the Rotary Club would take on one project after the next, and you would get to know your fellow Rotarians. And that was true of most organizations like that. Today, we're much less likely to engage organizations that have that sort of breadth and length, and much more likely to pick up and put together a coalition of folks who all agree on a single issue, say, to build more bike lanes downtown. And people engage in that issue, and once the issue is resolved, they disperse and invest in a different sort of organization. So this shift is evident not only in just individual lives, but it begins to be refracted through the sorts of institutions that we invest our time and energy in.
Okay, and we'll move along.
I just wanted to say, I want to take another call, but doesn't sometimes this online communication often lead to more offline communication? Can't it nurture relationships and so that they can become more middle ring?
Absolutely. That certainly can happen. And I think there are times when it has. The question is whether in the broad majority of cases, right, that's what happens. So there's a sort of a funny example that I imagine in my book, which is that you've got a member of the Klan in Kentucky who's hawking a baseball card on eBay. He could sell it to a black woman who lives in Oakland and runs her own small business. They would interact. They would have this maybe a substantial financial relationship where she sent money to him and he sent the card to her. And they might not ever know what the other's point of view on anything is, right? That's a connection that they've made. It's a connection that probably would have been impossible several generations ago, but now it's possible. And the truth is that as much as they are actually in a commercial relationship, they don't have any better view of one another at all. And so there are all sorts of examples of this. You know, there are these online video games where people will develop relationship with other people, and they'll plan, for instance, to meet online at 8 o'clock and storm a castle. And those, it's not to disparage those relationships. They can be meaningful, and in some cases, people who are in Hong Kong and in Miami might storm a castle together online one night, and then at some point meet for coffee, right? Maybe they would choose to meet in L.A. sometime. But in a lot of cases, it's not. It's just a relationship that happens online. There is not the sort of depth to it that would have occurred in the typical relationship that happened in the 1950s.
And we'll take a short break on the program. We'll come back and talk to Carol and Andre. This is Topical Currents, Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and Mark Dunkelman. We'll be back with more.
Welcome back to today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and Mark Dunkelman. He's a research fellow at Brown University and a senior fellow at the Clinton Foundation. He's written The Vanishing Neighbor, The Transformation of American Community. Let's go right back to the phones. Let's speak to Carol in Miami.
Miami, yes.
Hi, Carol.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I was very provoked by the title of the book, Vanishing Communities, and I wanted to just talk a little bit about the personal experience I had and then give some ideas for a discussion. I was born in the early 60s and lived in the States until the early 80s, and then I moved overseas and spent 20 years living in a small rural community in South America. Moved back here in the early 2000s and really was struck by basically what your guest is describing, that there is a real lack of community in many of the suburban areas, and I would say here in Miami. So, you know, you don't know your neighbors, et cetera. And my observation in just looking at the two, really distinct lifestyles that I was experiencing is that in the community in South America, basically, that your neighbors, you actually needed your neighbors for meeting your basic needs. You know, we all need food, clothing, shelter. And so the people who are closest to you actually provide those basic needs. You need to get together with people to make sure that the water system in the community is running. You need to get together with people to make sure that the grass gets cut because there's not, you know, a city system to cut the grass or whatever. And here, a lot of those basic needs are pretty much taken care of, and they're taken care of by people who are far away from you. So it doesn't force you into the situation of actually having to interact with people who are close to you but may not be of the same mind as yourself.
Right.
That was my comment.
Okay. And what did you want to suggest now?
No, that was just an observation, and I'd like to hear your guests, any comments that your guests may have on it.
Okay,
oh, okay.
Thanks for calling.
Thank you.
Well, it's a really poignant vignette of what's happened, and there's a whole portion of my book where I talk about an old theory by a psychologist named Abraham Maslow, which he calls the hierarchy of needs, and what he argues is that as you begin to satisfy sort of your most basic needs, food, clothing, shelter, a job, you begin to move up in this hierarchy and begin to care about what's on the next rung. So once you've satisfied your need for food and shelter, you begin to want security. And once you've got security, you begin to want some stability. And as you move up further and further, as your life becomes more comfortable, you begin to focus on other things. Closer to the top of the hierarchy is the need for self-expression. And what we're finding is that as American life has become much more comfortable over the course of the last several decades, our desire for self-expression is driving us to find people who think the same way that we do. And the caller, Carol, was absolutely right that in the absence of needing your neighbor for the support, for the security, for all the items that are on the lower rungs that have now been satisfied by other institutions, we are less inclined to reach out to the person who lives next door. It's a really, really important driver of this phenomenon. And it's a shift that's not getting enough, in my view, it's not getting enough attention, because it's right there at the root of why American government doesn't work the way we want it to, why we're not seeing the boost in economic growth that we expected after the Great Recession, why it seems like our entitlements are about to go off the rails because there's too much demand. Mm. In all these cases, those relationships that used to exist in the middle rings, which helped us form what Tocqueville in the 1830s called townships, in the absence of those relationships, it's much harder to find ways to build compromise, to find new ideas, to support people who are old and infirm. And the question is, how are we going to adjust to the shift right there at the foundation of townships and middle ring relationships?
Well, that is the question. How are we?
Well, it seems to me that a few things could happen. One is, as your first caller said, it may be that future generations of Americans are more inclined to invest in the middle rings. My family moved from Washington, D.C. a year ago to Providence, Rhode Island, specifically to a street that we knew people, we knew that we would eventually learn who our neighbors were and we would have a relationship with them. We were desperate to find that sort of environment, and it may be that future generations do that. Alternatively, we may begin to build institutions that help us build middle ring relationships. So, for example, there's a new social networking application called Nextdoor, where they are using technology to build a sort of an alternative to Facebook that is about geography, that helps you learn who lives nearby. And then the third possibility is that we begin to embrace a public policy program proactively tries to help Americans rebuild these sorts of cross-cutting cultural relationships. So on that front, there's sort of two things we could do. One is to expand the opportunity to build relationships. So for one, we could build out AmeriCorps and other national service programs that are designed to do service in the community, but really their auxiliary benefit and maybe really their most important asset is that they drive together people who come from different parts of the country. So if you spend 18 months in AmeriCorps and you're from Miami, you're likely to spend time with people who are from California and Maine and Minnesota and have a really substantive time talking to them in their diversity. And the second thing is, and this is right at the forefront of the movement for educational reform, we could spend more time trying to imbue students with what educational scholars are calling grit, which is the ability to withstand the impulse to lash out or turn away when you come up against a challenge. Mm-hmm. If you meet someone who disagrees with you, the crucial question is whether you'll be able to withstand the impulse to say, ugh, I don't want to deal with that guy. I don't want to talk to that woman. I'd rather find somebody who I already agree with. And if we can get people, if we can provide students with more self-control, it will turn out not to be just a benefit to them, because it turns out that this sort of this non-cognitive skill that's being called grit is twice as powerful as IQ when determining an eighth grader's GPA. Mm. If we can drive people, if we can provide future generations with additional grit, it will not only help them individually, it will actually begin to rebuild these frayed middle ring relationships.
We're very short on time, Mark, but how would, if we take more advantage of middle ring relationships, would it improve our economy?
Well, there's all sorts of data and research now that suggests that good ideas don't just come like a bolt of lightning. It's not that someone is sitting there in bed one night and suddenly they think up the iPhone, or that Gutenberg was just sitting there in his studio and suddenly thought of the printing press. Good ideas happen when people bring various ideas together into the same conversation. So Steve Jobs, when he thought of the iPhone, took all these existing technologies, mobile telephony, satellite connectivity, a graphical interface, and put them in one device. He was merging different ideas from different parts of the technological world. Gutenberg was taking a movable type and ink and paper and a press. He put them all into one thing. In middle ring relationships, you begin to find people who have different ideas, and they begin to have conversations, and they begin to borrow from what someone said about an article they read in the paper that they would not have noticed, or this is something that I learned about in school, or this is something that my wife was telling me about, and you begin applying different ideas to new situations. That's where good ideas come from. That's where innovation comes from. And in the absence of having a lot of middle ring relationships, there are fewer and fewer innovative ideas. The crucial example of this is Detroit at the beginning of the 20th century. We think of Detroit now as sort of an industrial wasteland, But the reason that Detroit became the center of the automobile industry was because on the shores of the river in Detroit, at the beginning of the 20th century, there were carriage manufacturers who were supplying carriages for those moving out west. There were engine designers and shipbuilders for people that were working on freighters on the Great Lakes.
Let's squeeze in one more phone call before we leave. Andre, I'm very short on time in Plantation. Hi.
Thank you. Thanks for taking my call. Real quick, I was wondering, to what extent is religion and the fact that more people were religious than are now in the 50s and early 60s, and in fact, the middle ground back then on important issues, ethical issues, issues of morality, rather than being different, people with differences being brought together, they were actually people with the sameness in terms of the important things of life, so that when it started to separate fewer people being religious, the issues like a woman's right to choose or whether an abortion is murder or not took away our ability to get together with those folks, because how do you ever change someone who thinks that an abortion kills somebody, or how do you change someone who thinks that a woman doesn't have a right to choose? And I think to that extent, it increased the sides versus the middle ground.
Okay, Mark, do you have a comment?
Yeah, it's an interesting point, and I talk a lot about religion in the book. The crucial change that's happened, because it turns out that a lot of Americans are still religious today, is that over the course of the last 50 years, we've become more inclined to find congregations that have exactly the liturgy we prefer. So it used to be that you tended to go to your neighborhood church, or you went to the church where your parents went. Today, we're much happier to travel further to find a church that has exactly the dogma and the liturgy that appeals to us. And so that in the course, it used to be the congregations brought together a bunch of diversity. Today, in many more cases, they bring together people who already have the same point of view.
Well, Mark Dunkelman, it's been really an interesting and insightful hour with you. We thank you so much for joining us. He is a research fellow at Brown University Center for Public Policy and American Institutions and a senior fellow at the Clinton Foundation. His writing has appeared in several publications, including The Washington Post and Politico, and his latest book, The Vanishing Neighbor, The Transformation of American Community. We want to thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
And that wraps up today's program. More information at WLRN.org or the Topical Currents Facebook page. Our producer, Richard Ive, technical direction from online producer Paul Leary, and happy Rosh Hashanah for our friends and listeners. Tomorrow's Topical Currents is Bonnie Berman's visit with journalist Helene Olin. In her book, she says well-known TV personal finance experts engage in dubious, even deceitful practices, such as payments from banks in exchange for promoting certain products. That's tomorrow.
And you too. You were there.
Oh, yes. That's right.
Yeah.
Friday at this time, it's Ed Bell and the South Florida Arts Beat. Monday, we address the perils and finances of major surgery. And see our WLRN webpage or the Topical Currents Facebook page for more info. Bonnie, should I resume the old calendar on our program? I'm thinking about it.
All right, well, let's find out from our listeners.
This is Joseph Cooper with Bonnie Berman. Stay tuned for Here and Now from NPR News.